This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today is Friday. It's Good Friday, as
it
we just heard
Friday.
From Keith Gum. And of course, we have Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist for the Doctor in the House segment. How are you today, George?
I'm very good. It's a very good Friday. It's not raining.
It is a beautiful Friday, actually.
It is a wonderful Friday.
And we're also talking about something that's really very meaningful. Mm-hmm. We're talking about why the patient matters, patient-centered care. So this is sort of in the context of Palliative Care Awareness Month, which falls in April. And this year's theme is Speak Up Because I Matter. Mm-hmm. This brings home the point that the patient should be at the center of good healthcare delivery. And, well, we have heard discussions about patient-centered care in many contexts, and sort of in the abstract. But what does this mean to those who offer this care, like mm-hmm. doctors like yourself, George, and other healthcare professionals? And so we have in the studio with us Dr. Adnin Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. And he has brought his little elephant in.
That's right. Is that a hospice mascot, right?
It is for now, yes.
All right, okay.
All right, so remember you can call us if you have any questions. The number is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Adnin, I would like to start with the idea of patient-centered care. In fact, this topic came from hospice, you. So why did you want to focus on this?
Really, because we live in a very paternalistic society, and the patients, who are generally the weaker side of the balance in the healthcare scale, are technically at the mercy of the healthcare system. Mm. They have to negotiate all sorts of barriers and issues to hopefully to get what they want in terms of the healthcare issues. The system is never really set up for them. The system is set up for ease of other people, whether it's the healthcare workers, the corporate, the government, or whatever else. Yeah. And the patients are left to try and figure out, what does this mean for me? What is in healthcare and what isn't in healthcare? It's the people, it's just like things like wars, isn't it? The people that win decides what's best for the people that don't win.
Yes.
I mean, you're absolutely right. The key word here is vulnerability, mm-hmm. isn't it? I mean, we talked about patient-centered healthcare in all sorts of specialties, like, for example, asthma. You know, you said patients have to be empowered to do that. Particularly in palliative care, that is crucially important because this person, the individual, is very vulnerable mm-hmm. and also facing the
pretty serious situation.
So yep. under those circumstances, is that even possible to empower somebody?
You can empower. I think there's two parts of empowerment. One is giving them permission mm-hmm. or giving them the ability to speak up. Can we create an environment where they can say anything without shutting them up mm-hmm. or to tell them that this is irrelevant? The agenda is normally done by the healthcare worker.
Right.
The patient's agenda may be something that's maybe sometimes outside the healthcare environment, but connected. It might be issues such as costs, caregiver distress. Does the doctor want to listen to that?
Yes.
That's all your problems.
Yeah, I mean, you highlighted it, how multifaceted this is, because on one hand, one stakeholder is the doctor themselves, whether the doctor want to let go of empowerment. On the other hand, it's the family, isn't it? Because family is quite a crucial part mm-hmm. of this. And then whether family wants to let their parents know, not knowing, is one part. The other thing which I always come across is this knowledge, you know, obviously, how much do you know? How much are you empowered to know what decisions to take will be key issues. I think in the centre of all this, I think in Hospice Malaysia, who you work with, obviously plays a crucial role to amalgamate all these factors together. Would you not think that is the factor here?
It is. But, you know, I worked as a family practitioner before, mm-hmm. and it's always finding out really what matters to the person that's in front of me first.
Right.
Is the agenda what it was setting decided by the patient or by me, the healthcare person?
Right.
You know, customer is always right. So if you come to me and you tell me your problem and I solve your problem, you're a satisfied customer.
Yes.
If you come to me and I tell you you've got problems that you don't even know about, right, that's a different matter.
Indeed.
That, I mean, we, like you said, you described it as paternalistic, and we are in this situation where it's always doctor knows best. Does that necessarily automatically contradict a patient's best interests?
Does the doctor really know best?
Do they?
Well, it's cultural, isn't it? Because in certain part of the world, that is always patient perceived doctor knows best. And you're right.
You've got three dichotomies. You've got the patient that may want full autonomy. Mm-hmm. You've got a patient that would like the doctor to make all the decisions because they believe the doctor knows best. Mm-hmm. And you've got the ones in between that wants to have a shared decision-making situation. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to find out which category does the patient sit first before you decide, I'm going to tell you what you need.
And that presumably is the art of your work, your craft, and also challenges that you face every day.
Yeah, it should be everyone.
But what about for you, George? Because I'm sure this applies not just to palliative care, across all specialties healthcare.
Yes.
What does patient-centered care mean to you?
Well, okay. Patient-centered care, for me, I think predominantly is that empowerment. So I find several challenges in order to apply that in a Malaysian setting. First of all, I highlighted earlier on that culturally, it's always perceived that doctors know best. And that that sort of hierarchy is always not challenged. And I think when that is evolving, the cultural change needs to happen both in the patient side and the doctor side. The second part, which I find challenging, is when patient cared, you assume that you have the awareness and knowledge. Let's say, for example, a very simple thing like a patient presented with a tumor marker that's high. And then to have the biopsy or not to have the biopsy, what does that mean? And then exactly what does cancer mean if it's detected? Patient really need to have that basic knowledge before you are empowered to make that decisions. The third thing which I call is the family interference. It's all done out of good
intentions,
gesture,
yeah.
Good intention. However, sometimes diagnoses are made, families say, don't tell. That puts everybody in this really awkward situation that you have a diagnosis, it's all hush-hush, then you have to use different terms in order to beat around the bush. So I think that, again, will hamper that patient-centered care. And last thing I think is very unique to Asian culture is what I call background noise. It's all the neighbors recommending some lotion and potion, some grass and from somewhere.
Yes.
And then that sort of thing always may lure you towards uncharted territory. Mm. And I really am quite interested in see how Dr. Anin faced these sort of issues every day and how to resolve these sort of four variables in order to ensure patient-centered care.
It's a daily occurrence.
Absolutely.
You suggested that this may be cultural. I don't quite necessarily quite agree, because I've seen similar things pretty well everywhere around the world. So it's not quite sort of a Malaysian sort of essence, and it's part of human behaviour that's deemed to be protective. But the reason we have some of these issues here a lot more than maybe some other country is because we've created a system where the family steps foot in the door first before the patient, instead of some of the other countries where you address the patient first and you ask the patient, is there anyone you want to be in the room with you?
Good point.
And in other countries, I've had patients who said, I need to know what I want to know. And some of them have said, please, will you not let my family know? Mm-hmm. Because they'll worry so much. And when they worry so much, I suffer. So sometimes they would prefer not to do that. And you can think what would happen, the families would be having their hands up in the air and says, the doctor won't tell me. In the typical solution that you've described here, where that sort of deed has been done, where the family has been told but not the patient, usually what I would do is that I would ask the family, can I just talk about the patient, about his or her life, and find out what's important in their life? What's going on here? Why are you here at this hospital and seeing this Pakka Oncology?
Mm-hmm.
And the general perception is families may think that their dear loved one hasn't got a working brain down there.
The insight to handle this.
And the vast majority of patients actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They may not know the definite details, but they know that because they've had pain, because something has happened to them, they're losing a lot of weight, they are not well. Mm-hmm. So whether the family is saying, don't tell them they've got cancer, whatever else, they know something's not right. Mm-hmm. And they've seen other people. They're usually elderly, so they've got experience. They've seen other friends and other family members that may not have had similar health-related problem, and they don't know. So the vast majority knows. And then there's this process of knowing and not knowing. So what we tend to do is asking the patient. So the patient would then say something and whatever else. And in many cases, the patient knows.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got something really, really bad. And then you ask, what do you need to know about this? And then the information
flows.
It's
always a very delicate situation. Yeah. I don't envy your daily positions when faced with such challenges.
Yes. Is it difficult, though, to bring autonomy back to the patient? Having described the kind of situation that we find ourselves in, how do we tell patients
I don't find it difficult.
No? No?
I don't find it difficult. If I'm talking to you, I just talk to you and I ask you what's important to you about for you. Sometimes it's a language that we use. So people will say, who looks after you? That's not giving center place for you. I may ask you, do you need looking after?
Right.
Who's important to you instead of where's your husband or where's your sons and daughters and whatever else? That makes you the secondary point of attention. So my questions are always directed to you as a person. Have you got pain? What do you need to know?
Do you ever encounter challenges whenever you give that patient opportunity to highlight what are their requirements? And they throw the ball back into your court and say, doctor, you know best. You treat me the way you see best. Or patients somehow in denial and not really wanted to take charge and wanted to do that. And it will be interesting to hear your views about how do you handle situations
it's
like that.
It's a poison chalice because ethically, that's not right. You are not that person.
But ethically not right, but you're left in that situation where the ball is in your court.
If you're trained well, that should not be a problem because it is an ethical challenge and you are not that person. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what kind of shirt would you want to wear.
That's right.
I may pick a polka dot shirt that I would like, but you may not like.
Exactly.
So that doesn't normally work.
Always a real challenge.
So I usually will ask the patient, what are the important values in your life? And I will tell the patient, I can't answer this question for you, but I will work with you so that we can get these answers together.
I think the key to do that, to achieve that, is building the rapport. I'm sure that we eventually will discuss that issue. And then I'm sure we'll invite lots and lots of questions from the listeners out there who probably will face such challenges or who actually are in such dilemma at the moment.
Yeah, tell us about your interactions with the healthcare system as such, because Dr. Adnan has talked about helping you, how he would help somebody in your situation work through the process to be able to make the decision together. What are the challenges that you face in trying to do that with healthcare professionals? You can call us at 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back after a few messages on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We have Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio today for the Doctor in House segment. We are talking about patient-centered care, and joining us as well is Dr. Adnan Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. We've had a very robust discussion before the break about what patient-centered care means in the society that we live in, because we're still largely very paternalistic, looking to the doctors to tell us what to do. And Dr. Adnan, you said that if there's a situation where the patient says to you, what was it, George, that I want you to make the decision
so
for
the
me.
The ball is certainly put in the doctor's court, and actually, you know best for me, doctor.
And you said, Dr. Adnan, that it's not right for you to make that decision.
I don't know best for you.
Yes.
Yes.
And you
I
have
know the
to,
best for me.
Yes. Which will not necessarily be the best for the patient. And you have to take the patient through the process.
Yeah.
But how many healthcare professionals have that kind of time to do it? George, you know, you have clinics packed.
The time, the patience, the rapport. Because you probably need to meet somebody quite a few times, right?
That's the nature of patient-centered care. You create a situation where you don't have time for the patient. Mm-hmm. So the system has been created without the patient in mind. Mm-hmm. And then the patient has to fit into it instead of... if I need the time, I'm going to have as much time as I need with that situation. Mm-hmm. So the question is that, can we be more effective on our use of time? Mm-hmm. And many clinicians haven't really been trained adequately in how you could actually get to where you want in a faster way. I mean, some of the ways that we talk to patients is very... It's usually a situation where we ask a lot of questions to get information, which may not necessarily lead us to understand what's going on to the patient. We get a heck of a lot of information, and then from that information, we may make some assumptions and perhaps be judgmental on some things. But sometimes, with the end of that, we don't understand what's actually meaningful.
Doctor Anin, I mean, obviously, you are the CEO for Hospice Malaysia, and in the context of giving patient-centred care, and also build that rapport for the journey of patients in palliative situations. Can you, for the benefit of the listeners out there, describe exactly what is Hospice Malaysia and it's the organisation itself, and how do you come about helping patients to go through the journeys and make the right decisions?
I mean, Hospice Malaysia has been around since 1991. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, we are probably the largest community palliative care organization in the country. We look after about 2,000 patients a year, the vast majority with cancer. Mm-hmm. The nature of the work that we do, as I said, in terms of patient-centered, is whenever we probably are referred 10 to 15 patients a day, and we try and see the patient usually within 24 and 48 hours of being referred, depending on the schedule that they can make. And as I would then say, when we see the patient, we may spend a few hours with the patient to find out what really are their problems. So it really is the patient as well as the caregivers, so the patient as well as the family. And then after they've given us a whole list of issues that we need to deal with, is then looking at prioritization, which are the most important things that they want to be solved. And then it's a case of, okay, if, say, pain is a dominant issue, what outcome do they want? I want pain relief. When do you want pain relief by? If they say, I need my pain to be relieved by 10 minutes, might need to negotiate that. If they say, you know, can you reduce my pain by 50% in a few days? Yep, I think we can do that. So we negotiate what the outcome that they want, and then work through a treatment plan with them. And then we go from there. And things like, when do we see them next and whatever else, again, it's negotiation with them as to what might be possible. So everything is sort of from the patient side.
So what's the worst case scenario? You know, a practitioner who doesn't take the patient's needs into account, how would that kind of conversation play out?
What we tend to get a lot of patients that maybe have exited the healthcare system that do not want to go back to hospital because in many ways, their needs have not been addressed. There have been, I mean, cancer patients, for example. Many cancer services sometimes don't tell the patient, you have failed chemotherapy.
Because failure is quite a taboo to discuss.
The disease may have not responded. The patient never failed.
Right.
But the way we communicate it, you have failed chemotherapy.
Right.
That's not right.
Putting it on the patient.
So you put it onto the patient. The patient has no responsibility as to whether they're
but
cancer.
But that's somatic, isn't it? At the end of the day, the treatment fails.
It means a lot for the patient. The patient hears, I failed. The patient does not think, my cancer did not respond. The doctor said, I failed.
Right.
And it makes a lot
of difference. Okay, right, okay. I mean, coming back to the situation you described earlier, you said Hospice Malaysia handles 2,000 referrals per year. And would that be across Klang Valley or just up and down the country?
Across Klang Valley.
Klang Valley only?
Only. At any point, we probably have about 500 to 600 patients.
Okay, all right. I'm a bit surprised. Obviously, there are many more sufferers who are in the palliative journey.
Yep.
And if Hospice Malaysia handles 2,000, what happened to the rest of them?
Good point. They're not being handled.
Okay.
When we did a needs analysis a few years ago, I think we estimate that of the total need in the country, Malaysia is only dealing with about 10% of the palliative care needs.
Right.
That's from all the, from the hospital side and other community services.
So can I be provocative and ask why? Why September? Is this because Hospice Malaysia failed to reach out to them? Or is it because the general public are not aware and healthcare providers are not really aware of such services?
I think it's the healthcare system. What do we want? What do we want to promote in terms of dealing with the spectrum of life and death? Mm-hmm. We celebrate birth and we grieve on death.
Right.
So areas of dealing with patients who are elderly and more frail are never in the highlight of healthcare planning.
Mm-hmm. How do we fare compared to our neighbouring countries when it comes to hospice services? You highlighted that perhaps you only captured about 10% of the patients, and then you provide patient-centred care. And then what would our neighbours, Singapore, for example, is doing?
Oh, gosh, you don't want to compare to Singapore.
We always do. We compare everything from nasi lemak to everything.
You probably might want to compare with Bangladesh or somewhere like that. I think the Economist did a survey in 2015. They call it the Quality of Death Index, where they looked at end-of-life care in 80 countries, including most of the Asian countries. Malaysia fared number 38 out of 80.
Right.
Singapore was number 12.
Okay.
And most of the other ASEAN countries are actually below us.
Okay. So that gives us some idea what sort of like a number we're capturing, right?
Taiwan is number 6.
Number 6.
Okay. UK is number 1.
All right. Okay. So obviously different countries have different cultural approach to providing that hospice care. So at the moment, obviously with less and less stigma about death and then palliative care, the services that you provide will be expanding.
Yes, it is expanding.
Right. And how do we instill that cultural adaptation to celebrating death, or actually not necessarily
celebrating death, but
actually, you know, make it patient-centered. For example, you're having a campaign at the moment trying to make it patient-centered
with diagnosis of things like cancer being, you know, cancer is extremely topical. Everyone's quite worried about cancer.
Of course.
As soon as you diagnose somebody, you know, I'm afraid you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The unspoken thing there is, am I going to die?
Yes.
And that's never really addressed. They address what are my treatment chances and whatever else. But underlying all of that, what's going to happen to me? Knowing that a lot of patients with cancer are not going to survive that ordeal. So that's where the patient-centeredness comes in. What's really important to you after knowing this diagnosis? And the patient sometimes will be thinking more in terms of reviewing their life. What's have my life been worth all this while?
Of course.
They're worried about their loved ones, worried about leaving others behind and thinking about what's their legacy going to be.
Mm.
And because of that, they're then thinking about what treatment. So it's actually about life first with a possibility of death that comes in and then the treatment. The doctors ignore all of that first and then think about, okay, let's plan your treatment for you.
Right.
So all that initial shock is never really picked up.
Understood.
Are our healthcare professionals equipped to be a different kind of communicator?
Communication skills training is not really within our training, within our education.
It's evolving though.
It's evolving. I had 6 months of communication skills training, and I think that was overseas, but here it's not really,
of course,
part of the process. So,
what can we do now? I mean, we are going to have generations more of younger healthcare professionals coming
up. Well, I do work with a lot of patient groups, and I've been basically wanting them to speak up. Tell the doctors what's important for you. And getting the families also asking questions. Unfortunately, in some situations, when they have dared to ask too many questions to the clinicians, they are sent to the psychiatrist because you're asking too many questions. You must be depressed.
Oh, dear. Okay. I mean, obviously, earlier on, you highlighted that the patient-centered care, I think one of the crucial role you play is actually reaching out to the to the patient in their
homes
and community. I think that is one of the key advantages you have, to understand their needs, to actually understand their environment rather than them going to a clinic. I think that is absolutely crucial. Of course, that
they behave differently.
Of course, because this is their natural environment. They will think about what they really want. And then you also, you mentioned you spend hours understanding their needs, understanding their suffering, and also help to counsel them to plan for whatever they have not achieved in their lives. First of all, many people will ask, without that referral from a doctor, can somebody initiate hospice care?
No.
See, that's one issue. So it needs to go through a gatekeeper.
It needs to.
Yeah. Okay. The second issue is that obviously with that, we need huge amount of manpower and resources. It'll be interesting to see how Hospice Malaysia fund itself and also how Hospice Malaysia plan to expand.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I'll address the first issue into the aspects of gatekeepers, because I think it's important. Many patients come to us directly, and they say, I've got this problem with my lung. I don't quite know what's going on. I've seen this doctor and whatever else. I need to know what's going on with that patient, the clinical aspects of it. Mm. Because if this patient is vomiting or whatever else, is this vomiting because of food poisoning? Is it because of hypercalcemia? Is it because they've got brain metastases? It's a clinical discipline. And so without that clinical data, I'm sort of wandering in the dark thinking what's going on here. And we've had patients who have not been given adequate information from the doctor, or some situations where they've been lied. So we've had a patient saying, you know, I'm coughing, I've got chronic bronchitis. You've got cancer of the lung. It's just that information did not come true.
Understood.
So I need to know what treatment, and sometimes they've had treatment that hasn't worked, so I don't want to duplicate them having something which has failed before.
Of course.
So that's why it has to go through a gatekeeper to find out the medical information. Now, with regards to the planning and increasing of services, I think that we are pretty happy with what we're doing, and what I'm working now with the government and others is to expand palliative care services across the country.
Which is crucial.
And that's what the Deputy Minister has also mentioned in his speech last week, the expansion of domiciliary palliative care. It requires, but you know, it's the same thing as we are demanding certain things to happen. It's how do we get that across?
It takes time.
It takes time. Training takes time. And palliative care and things like that, that's not really the most favoured profession that many doctors may want to go in. Mm-hmm. So although the need is there, we need people to step forward as nurses.
How many palliative care consultants do we have in the country currently?
About 14, I think.
14, serving the whole nation.
Yes.
All right, okay. And how many staff do you have in Hospice Malaysia to carry out the work? And who are they?
We've got about 35 or something like that.
35 serving 2,000 patients?
Yeah, I've got about 18, 19 nurses, and we've got three doctors between us.
And is that enough?
Well, it's never enough.
It's never enough.
But, you know, our healthcare expenditure in the country is so much anyway.
Exactly.
It's never enough.
Obviously, that is grossly deficient in the service. I mean, you mentioned that the index showed UK is doing very, very well, top of the list, you know, top of the class. What can we learn in the UK system that we can have that sort of like top of the rank patient-centred care?
UK is probably going down now with Brexit and everything
else. All right, okay.
But I think that it's looking at the whole structure. I worked in the NHS for some time, and I like the idea of the structure that you have. I think that we have a lot of wastage within our system, with people going to see first, second, third opinions and whatever else. There's no clear guidance, there's needs. People are going to see specialists with minor problems when they could sort of see GP. So there's a huge amount of wastage that goes on in the system. If we are more efficient, I think we can do a lot better. The equilibrium between private public side also needs to move better together, so that it can actually deal more effectively with all of these problems.
Okay. Well, the NHS is a system that's riddled with its own problems, its own bureaucracies. And I still want to come back to the system because, as you've said, Dr. Adnan, it's if doctors are working within the system that puts patients in a certain in a box, you know, how do we navigate that? We will discuss that when we come back after the break. We're talking about patient-centered care today, and we have, of course, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Dr. Adnan Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia, in the studio today. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We have Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, in the studio, as well as Dr. Adnan Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. We are talking about patient-centered care. And before the break, Dr. Adnan, you cited the UK as a model that we can aspire to.
In some ways.
In some ways.
From leaving the European Union.
Yes. But you know, we also hear about the NHS being a system that's inherently flawed in many ways. And I see some similarities with our system. I mean, I know you've talked about the fact that the patient is not placed in the center, and it's because of the way our healthcare system is structured to approach the management of illnesses. But how do we change that?
It requires a mindset. It requires studies to find out what they want and what's right and what's wrong. We did the same thing in Hospice Malaysia a few years ago, because we were wondering how well we are in terms of patient-centered care. So we went out to do a qualitative study of our patients. We had focus groups and we interviewed a lot of them, patients and family members. And what we were somewhat sort of surprised by the results. We were generally quite happy that most of our patients felt that we were addressing their concerns. Mm-hmm. But what was surprising was the caregivers felt that they felt that we had the balance wrong. We were concentrating. We were not giving the caregivers enough attention.
All right.
So that came out, and we were surprised by that. But because of that, we changed our approach. We instigated more resources to addressing caregiver needs,
right?
As well.
It's interesting you highlighted that. You know, because early on in the show, I mentioned that there are several stakeholders, obviously a patient in the center of all that. The caregivers seems to be the one that is deficient in your survey.
Yes.
In that. I mean, obviously, in our part of the world, you always get that background, which I described earlier on. When somebody at the time under your care highlighted that they are interested in mumbo jumbo and, you know, all sorts of lotion and potions. That's right. Okay. And sometimes those sort of things, in the least harmful manner, will cost them a lot of resources. In a more harmful manner, might be even
detrimental
to their health. Because I'm talking, and this is quite personal to me, because 15 years ago, I guess I wasn't aware of you know, the integral structure of palliative care when my father was facing issues of palliative treatment with hepatic cancer. And what really broke my heart is that he, despite having two kids, are doctors, it probably believe in neighbors more than anything else. And under those circumstances, the caregivers themselves were finding it difficult. I just dread to think that when you're in the center of all these, trying to coordinate a patient-centered care, faced with all these challenges, how do you handle that?
And there is a lot of techniques that we would use in dealing with all of this. It requires time, it requires effort, and it requires some skill sets which are quite useful. Having a family conference is very, very important to bring everyone together on the same page. Malaysia is sometimes quite difficult to organise, because sometimes they may not want to come together. There are fractions within families.
Yes.
But you need to be able to do that. You need to then decide who's the most important thing here. Everyone's got their own problems. Somebody may say, I've got to look after the kids. Somebody says, I don't have time. I've got my own career and everything else. So everyone's got little things, but we need to decide within the whole family, how do we deal with this main person that we love and care so much? And then we looked at each of their concern and each of their assumptions on what the other person's problems are. So one person says, her problem is not as good, as bad as mine. So we work things out. It may take a while, but we work out a rational plan that everyone could agree with. Mm-hmm. That might not be able to be done at the first meeting. It's a bit like, you know, Trump and Kim.
That's right.
Need to work that through.
Yeah. The other challenge I assume that is happening in a Malaysian setting, in a UK setting, obviously all this is funded by the state. In Malaysian setting, there's this big issues of money.
Out-of-pocket expenses.
That's right.
Yes. Okay.
And would you be able to help or guide them in order to get some degree of assistance and that sort of thing? I know Hospice Malaysia yourself, your charity already. How do you point them to the right direction so that in facing all that difficulties, the least thing that need to worry about is money?
Gosh, the country needs money, isn't it?
Of course, everyone needs money. But the thing is, when they're most vulnerable, we want to empower them with patient-centered care.
And that's where, I guess, you know, financial planning needs to be part of the healthcare discussion as well, as to what's really are the important things that we need to worry about. What can be obtained in a cheaper way? What is it that is essential and what is less essential? Mm. So sometimes, as you say, they may be spending a lot of money on unproven treatment, mm-hmm. Which they hope would benefit them. They may say, let's strive for this stem cell treatment that may cost tens of thousands and whatever. And they may have enough for one course, but they certainly may not have enough to be able to get the full thing. And they may feel that's something hopeful. So we need to address
and
hope
you're embroidered
and false
hope. In all these discussions whenever you're trying to highlight. And
yes.
And of course, it's heartbreaking to see they spend 20,000 on something and it'll probably be, borrowed money from Along and all sorts of issues like that. And it doesn't make your job easier.
It doesn't, but we sometimes find a way out of it. And that makes it worthwhile.
So I'm hoping to highlight here to create a patient-centered care in a setting like that with limited resources of 3 doctors and 8 nurses from Hospice Malaysia truly is not easy.
What would be your wish list, Dr. Adnan?
I think if I see a lot of patients that exit the healthcare system because they felt that they were not cared for. Most of the time people complain is because they felt that nobody's listened to them, they've not been attended to, somebody's been rude to them or done things which they felt are unnecessary. They sometimes are happy with the doctor, but they're not happy with the attendant person or whatever else. You know, being woken up at 6 o'clock in the morning when they haven't had a good night's sleep and whatever else, because cleaning up at 6 o'clock is more important than allowing somebody to sleep. Not being able to eat when they want to eat or whatever else. So what on my wish list is really to have patient representation at all levels in our healthcare system. You have patient support groups everywhere, whether they're cancers, diabetes, or all sorts of things. Bring them into the planning structure. Don't assume they're just customers and we know best for them. I had a patient who requires dialysis. He was very happy with the dialysis in the hospital, but for him, when he gets to the hospital, there was nobody ever that could help him to get from the entrance of the hospital to the dialysis clinic. Mm. And that was a big deal for him.
Yes.
But when he got to the dialysis clinic, that's fine. So where's the patient care?
I find that my biggest issue with navigating a hospital physically is the transition, being told after you've seen a doctor, being told that you have to get, for instance, an X-ray.
Yes.
And that requires you to find your way somehow to the imaging department, which could be very far away, having to wait ages without knowing what the process is. And it goes on to the next test and so on and so forth.
Add unnecessary stress.
It's huge stress.
Treatment-seeking behavior, because people will assume that going to get healthcare provision, it's a whole day event, and then by the time you come back, you probably feel even more ill than you started off with.
Absolutely,
it's exhausting.
Yes.
Yeah, it is indeed. Yeah, I mean, and in the very beginning of the show, you said that Hospice Malaysia looks after predominantly cancer care. So what? Who are the other patients that Hospice Malaysia also provide cares for?
I think the other big group are organ failures, mm-hmm. of which the majority would be renal failure. Mm-hmm. Patients on dialysis or potentially stopping dialysis. We've got a cohort of patients with respiratory failure, with heart failure as well, some Alzheimer's disease patients, a few motor neuron disease patients, mm-hmm. And some children with life-limiting conditions, chromosomal abnormalities, congenital abnormalities, heart problems, some cancers.
So contrary to most people's beliefs, it's not just cancer care.
Nope.
You're actually providing that palliative journey for many, many patients in many walks of life.
Yep. Very quickly, we just have a question on WhatsApp asking what's the difference between palliative care and hospice care?
Great question.
There is no difference. Hospice care was the original sort of version about caring for people with life who have serious diseases. Palliative care came out because the word hospice was deemed to be not very pleasant in French. So the French came out with palliative care.
Right.
So that's been used together, sort of hospice and palliative.
Interchangeable.
But except in America.
Is that in America? Well, I mean, is it true to assume that palliative physicians works in a hospital setting and hospice kind of reach out to the community? That's not a
not
right
really.
Assumption.
Not really. The way I explain myself is that palliative care looks after the impact of a disease onto a person.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact could be physical, social, psychological, or spiritual.
Right.
And your physician, attending physician, will look after the disease, the pathophysiology, the treatment that will reduce the disease and hopefully with the curative intent. But they generally may not focus so much on the impact of the disease. So it's designed to work hand in hand, mm-hmm. so that the palliative care person should work with the oncologist, with the urologist, with the surgeon, physician, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know, for people who want to know more about Hospice Malaysia, if they're seeking your services, what can they do?
Yeah, I mean, could you just elaborate because one of the questions I asked early on is that how is hospice funded?
Mm-hmm.
Is it purely charity? And I'm sure after the show today, many, many people are interested in finding out more about your services and more how to contribute towards the services.
I think that, yes, we are entirely charity-driven, and that's one of the limitations of what we can and can't do. I think our costs has been increasing every year as healthcare cost increases anyway, and we try and provide more services. They can go to our website, www.hospicemalaysia.org, and there's different ways of how people can donate. Donations to hospice or palliative care over the years, it's not very sexy. It's not very fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, we've had people that say that, why should we donate to a service that is not a curative concept.
So that the sort of mentality.
That mentality is of that this is not sexy. So, but you know, palliative care is becoming more important, and for the people, for the families who have a loved one that is suffering, they are the ones that are our main supporters.
Right.
So virtually everyone that we know have donated, usually we can find a link to someone that we have looked after.
Right. Okay. So the people who have been through the journey realizes how
important.
Valuable
yep.
you had contributes, and then they are giving back.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, we started the show talking about this patient-centered care, and obviously we highlighted all these challenges. I mean, you had a patient-centered care awareness week, and then how do you going to direct the Hospice Malaysia to the direction that perhaps we aspire to the NHS kind of level of care?
We are working with the ministry. We're working with patient support groups. We're teaching undergraduate, postgraduate students, and hopefully getting them to approach things in a different way. We have got sort of patient and families within different committees that we have so that we hear their voice all the time. And we encourage others to do the same thing. And hopefully their voice becomes stronger and what they would one will be achieved within the whole healthcare structure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're running out of time. Dr. Adnan, your final message on patient-centered care.
You matter. You're important. What do you want from the service? And speak up.
George?
I think the one key takeaway, I mean, it's been incredible show. Obviously, you know, Hospices Malaysia is doing a great job. One thing that I learned as a healthcare provider is that the active listening of your patient and then actually listening carefully. Because listening, we all say we listen, but active listening to find out what exactly is a priority of that patient will determine and actually assist that journey of palliative care afterwards or even healthcare in general.
Yes, because even we know time is so rare for healthcare professionals, but it's the way you deliver your message, it's the way you ask your questions, and it's what you get.
And you actively listen, and then only then you will find out what exactly the patient wants.
Yes. We've been speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Adnan Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia, about patient-centered care. This month is Palliative Care Awareness Month, and if you'd like to find out more about Hospice Malaysia, you can visit their website at hospice.org. You've been listening to hospice.org. Yes. Well, you can just look for Hospice Malaysia.
Hospice Malaysia.
And you've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.